Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Bina Venkatraman was a former senior advisor for climate change innovation in the Obama administration. She teaches at MIT, and she's the future editorial page editor for the Boston Globe starting in November. Venkatraman thinks a lot about the future and believes that we as individuals, organizations, societies don't. Her new book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Bina joins me now. Bina, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me.
You say that we are in a reckless age, Bina. What's different about today? Have there been eras of recklessness in the past? Kind of seems like we're kind of a reckless species. So what would be different today?
Well, people alive today are living a lot longer than our predecessors and our grandparents, for example. And we have a lot more knowledge and ability to shape the future at scale. So if you think about problems like climate change, where we are putting emissions in the atmosphere today that will shape the climate of centuries from now, or if you think about our knowledge of the half-life of our nuclear radioactive waste, we know more. We see more warning signs about how we affect the future. We know more about how long we're going to live and what we can expect. And so we're not. I talk in the Optimist Telescope, I write about Pompeii and how the ancient residents of Pompeii had no idea that Mount Vesuvius was about to blow and destroy their civilization. Well, we have that kind of knowledge. And so recklessness, I think, it requires you to have a sense of the warning signs. If not, you're just unfortunate.
Okay, so I guess part of what I'm wondering is, to what extent is our inability to respond to that information or to make better long-term decisions something that, I don't want to say that we can be faulted for versus not faulted for, but almost sort of species-level involuntary evolutionary behavior versus voluntary, myopic, we could change this kind of behavior?
Well, one of the most interesting discoveries in my process of researching the Optimist Telescope over 5 years, talking to scientists from all kinds of disciplines, including biology, psychology, anthropology, the sort of history of the origin of the species, was that it in fact is not a curse of human nature. We are not condemned to being short-sighted in all circumstances. It's certainly hard for us to think ahead. It's much easier to focus on what's right in front of us because we smell that donut on the counter. We can see it.
There is no donut on this counter and I can still smell it.
So, right. Yes. You can summon that because it's visceral and it's colorful and it's in your experience, in fact, to have eaten a donut, I would imagine.
And so regularly.
You know what it's like to conjure that. But to conjure an unimaginable future, a future that you haven't yet experienced in your mind, something like sea level rise or a change, a slow change in society or a technological change you've never experienced, that's really hard to conjure and it requires a leap of the imagination. But that's not to say it's impossible. And I think it's a dangerous misconception that is permeating our dialogue today, in part because we're so overwhelmed by a lot of what's going on in our politics and on the planet. It's this misconception that we're cursed to being short-sighted and therefore we should just kind of turn it in and accept that we're not going to be able to deal with problems of the future. And in fact, Jonathan Franzen, the novelist, wrote in The New Yorker in September that, you know, we are just too short-sighted as a species and we should accept the climate apocalypse is coming. Well, that, in fact, I think is a convenient way to excuse neglect of our obligations, and it vastly underestimates our potential. We are capable of thinking ahead. And one of the things that helps us to think ahead is to be in groups and environments with set norms, expectations, cultural norms that we share that help us think ahead.
So there's a lot to unpack there. And the first thing that I want to pick up is this word conjuring that you used. Because one of the things that was striking for me in the book, you give examples of everything from virtual reality simulations to watermark markers in Mattapoisett, Massachusetts, that show how high the water got last time it got really bad. So it does seem like you're finding hope, optimism, from the title of your book, in this ability to use both high and low tech to really help people visualize or engage their imaginations in ways that might change how we think about the future.
Absolutely. There are ways to overcome what are our cognitive biases to focus on the present, and it does require us to be specific. And what I found happening in Mattapoisett, which was led, by the way, by a young Eagle Scout, was a project to mark where the waters had flown, where the waters had risen to during past hurricanes, including Hurricane Bob and the historic hurricane of 1938 that we know was very destructive, and to use that as a way to show people in common places that they walk around town, on Main Street, on the golf courses around town, how bad things can get in a future storm so that they might do better at evacuating and sort of heeding the warnings about future storm surges. So these kinds of tools do hold a lot of promise sort of at the individual level for helping us imagine the future better. And at the collective level, there are tools we can use as well to help our imagination. And I write about the Pentagon's war games, for example, which invite people to play specific roles in scenarios in the future, and how that helps to overcome some of the barriers we have to putting ourselves into future scenarios. And I can talk more about that if that's of interest. But often when a scenario seems so awful to contemplate, it seems like doomsday, we have the tendency to say that won't happen, or we hope it won't happen. And so we'll just kind of take it off the shelf. And instead of sort of looking at it and saying, how can we prepare and make this not so bad?
That was actually one of the striking examples from your book, was that there was a police psychologist in 1972 who was charged with running essentially crisis scenarios for the 1972 Olympic Games in Germany. And scenario 21 basically was the terrorist attack on Jewish Israeli athletes that came to fruition. But that the Olympic officials didn't want to grapple with that possible future, so didn't take even the most basic security measures to prevent it.
That's right. And part of the reason they didn't take those measures was that they were sort of trying to correct for the past. So the Munich Olympics in 1972 were the first Olympics that were held in Germany after the 1936 Olympics, over which you'll remember Hitler presided. And the memory of that and the sort of shame of that was very much in the collective psyche of Olympic organizers as well as the German people. And they didn't want these games to be seen as militaristic or morose. They wanted to rebrand the games. In fact, they called them Die Heiteren Spiele, which means the cheerful games in German. And they didn't want to have security officers who were armed at the perimeter of the Olympic fence. And that led to a situation that was very vulnerable for the scenario that this police psychologist, Georg Zibor, predicted, in fact, which was that there would be an attack on Israeli athletes. And of course, it led to the massacre of those athletes. And this, I thought this story was really important to examine from the lens of today and for thinking about scenarios in the future, because we do have this tendency to sanitize what we hope won't happen. And so I looked at some of the tools like role play games and others that allow groups of people to more actively engage with those futures. It's not just painting the scenario of the future. Instead, you're invested in a sort of quasi-fictional scenario where you have to make decisions and be active. And when you activate people's emotions and show them that they have an actual stake in those futures, that it's not just something that's been painted for them, it can actually help overcome some of those barriers.
So, Bina, that example you just gave was a particular, arguably cultural moment in Germany's history. You mentioned earlier in our conversation the role of cultural norms. Another question that comes to mind is, are there cultures, for example, the sort of free market culture of the United States, which may be more driven by the quarterly profit cycle, for example, are there cultures that are more or less prone to the capacity to think long term?
It's hard to paint entire societies with a single brush. So, for example, if you look at the Chinese government, which is autocratic, does a lot of long-term planning, but there's no accountability because there aren't regular elections. It's not a democratic society with a free press. So it's not that you'd say that's a good model for long-term thinking. And if you look at the Chinese stock market, for example, it's very much short-term speculative. So I wouldn't paint whole cultures with particular brushes. That said, subcultures, groups of people that share cultural norms within societies, can in fact be more short-sighted or more able to think ahead. And as you said, corporate America is a great example of where there's a lot of people being driven by very much the near-term stock price, quarterly earnings and profits, and they're sacrificing value for all of us who are pension holders or 401k holders or shareholders in those companies on a routine basis by not putting those resources back into the company to invest in future invention or in growing market share. And that's been really documented well. I found subcultures in professional poker in Las Vegas, where the poker players were really valuing making calculated bets and amassing earnings over time instead of being impulsive, even in the very, you know, sort of instant gratification environment of the casinos of Las Vegas. And so that sort of stood out to me as a culture that could be cultivated within a sort of another dominant culture.
Yeah, I have to admit, if you'd given me a broad list of the subcultures you might have given as examples of great long-term thinking, professional poker players might not have been one I'd have picked off the list. But I saw from the book, I do see your argument there.
Yes. And, you know, this is something that can be used, for example, in hospitals. So I looked at Johns Hopkins Hospital and the way in which they're creating a culture and environment in the hospital to prevent doctors from overprescribing antibiotics. And another really fascinating example of cultural difference comes from the classic marshmallow test, where toddlers are given the choice to eat a treat immediately, like a marshmallow or a donut or a pretzel, or to wait for some indeterminate amount of time for a second treat to appear. And it turns out the subsistence farmers of Cameroon, the Nso community, NSO, to spell it for you, their toddlers pass this test at a rate of something like 70%, which is very high, whereas German and American toddlers typically pass the test at rates of something like 30 to 40%.
So there's a big cultural difference.
Big difference, and not something you would expect, right? You would think in poverty and scarcity, there might be more desire to just take as many treats as you can get right away. But there's something there happening culturally.
So we only have about a minute left, and I don't want to lose that minute without at least asking you one question about journalism, given your new role at the Boston Globe. Does journalism have its own problem with foresight? Or do we report in a way that allows for long-term thinking?
Well, I think we have a big responsibility at the moment in particular where we are drinking from the fire hose collectively when we read the news. There's so much to digest. It's coming at us very quickly in 24/7 news cycles, and the president is making news with his tweets. So we have to, I think, in some ways cover what is news, but also to offer readers and audiences a sense of perspective of what really matters. And a lot of times that incremental noise in the news gets in the way of really pointing to the long-term trends that are most important and where we have the highest stakes for our society, including problems like climate change and inequality and sort of the bigger challenges we face.
That is Bina Venkatraman. She's the incoming editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. She's also a former senior advisor for climate change innovation in the Obama administration and teaches in the program on science, technology, and society at MIT. Her new book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Thank you, Bina.
Thanks so much, Tiziana.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.